Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cathal Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
I'm well, and I know you were away for the last couple of days, and we just got to see each other for... I missed you. and I know that we just got to see each other just as we walked into the studio, but I know that you were down to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I had an interesting little trip. I went down to D.C. and spent some time in Baltimore just for a few days, but...
Washington is such a great restaurant town.
It's a great restaurant town, and of course, I went to a restaurant that I go to pretty much every time I'm down in D.C., a place called Haleo. Jose Andres, the chef there, one of my favorite restaurants in the world. Very casual. I went there Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, in jeans and a collared shirt, and was made to feel very, very comfortable. A really great experience, you know, and lots of interesting food. I actually went with my brother, his first time at Haleo, and I think he found it to be interesting as well, and shared a nice bottle of very reasonable wine. The wine prices are very, very reasonable.
Jose Andres was on the show and is one of the most important Spanish chefs in the United States. And he has a couple of places, Cafe Atlantico, Mini Bar Cafe Atlantico, and a couple of Haleos. But Haleos is a tapas bar. And he was very funny on the show because of his Spanish accent. He kept talking about how when he first introduced the concept to America, he had to keep explaining to people that it was not a topless bar, a tapas bar.
Well, I'll tell you, I think topless bars are still more popular than tapas bars in the country right now. So
yeah, but don't drink anything that doesn't come out of a bottle.
Anyway, we just had a really, really good time there. And, well, you know that Jose, one of the things Jose's now becoming famous for is he's brought Jamón Ibérico into this country. And Haleo is a very, very affordable restaurant, for those of you who don't know it. It's basically small plates, and the plates are anywhere from $7 to, let's say, $12, depending on what you have. Like, I had a quail stuffed with a foie gras mousse wrapped in prosciutto, and it was very delicious, and it was like $12. And then we had a salad with some Manchego cheese and roasted walnuts, and that was about $7. But one of the things he's famous for is bringing Jamón Ibérico, this very famous Spanish ham, to the United States. And he was selling Jamón Ibérico for $9 an ounce.
What?
Which is basically, just for those of you who don't know how the price of Jamón Ibérico came to this country, and if you bought, and Francis and I bought some whole hams, and basically it was about $90 a pound if you bought a whole ham.
In other words, that's a $1,000 ham you got hanging on
your budget. So, in other words, you have $1,000 if you bought a whole ham. So, I'm doing the math, and I'm sitting here going, this ham costs him $7 if he doesn't waste an ounce to put on a plate, and he's charging $9 for it. And I thought that was just really extraordinary that he was serving Jamón Ibérico, one of the hardest-to-find hams in the country, and one of the greatest hams in the world, for $2 over cost. Was
well, but he
beautiful.
Is the he is the importer,
right? I guess it's more.
So I'm sure that it cost him $5 an ounce,
and that's probably true.
Whereas it would cost us $7 an ounce.
Correct. You know, well, so without waste, like I said, so there's even on a ham, there's a little bit of waste.
Well, you know, one of the things that I find is interesting is, you know, when Haleo opened in Washington, the idea of tapas had to be introduced. Now, I traveled in Spain quite a bit, and I love the idea of tapas, you know, before it became fashionable in this country. But it's really taken over to a large extent, and it's sort of it's extended into small plates menus that I find are met with interest, and I don't know that they're quite successful yet in a lot of places. People don't know quite what to do with them. But the idea of tapas is a bunch of small things that you can order. So if you go to a tapas bar, you'd order maybe 5 or 6 little dishes. And somebody pointed out to me the other day that it's very much like the way we do our antipasto bar at Cathal Lombardi. But it's still not the same. Our antipasto bar, we have a selection of cold antipasti, you know, maybe a dozen selections or 15 selections. And you can order 3 or six or nine for various prices. So they say three is $12 and six is $15 and nine is $20.
Something like that.
But that's
you're
still
close.
Not,
I'll let it go.
But that's still not. But that's still not tapas, because in tapas you would be able to order each individual thing, and sometimes it comes in a tiny little plate, and it's just sort of a nibble, you know.
Well, I'll tell you one of the things that where Haleo is a little different than the last time I went was just a couple of years ago. Each of the plates at Haleo were a little bit bigger than they had been in the past. I noticed that. And one of the things the waiter said to me is, "Oh, you know, three of these would make a nice lunch." Where when I think of tapas, I think more along the lines of maybe five or six of them would normally make a full meal, a big meal. I'm a big guy.
Well, also, but also after you say they got bigger. If you go to Spain and you order a soda, you get a 9 or 10 ounce soda.
Right.
You don't get a 16 ounce soda or a big gulp. They don't exist. Mm-hmm. Tapas, where originally the word comes from. When they would serve you a glass of wine at a little taverna in Spain, historically, it would have a little plate on top of the glass with some olives or some nuts or something that they made in-house on, or some mushrooms or something, that would be on would top the glass, keep the flies out of the glass. And that was a tapa. You know, it's that's Spanish for, well, top. Not really that complex. And that's where the word comes from. I absolutely love Haleo, and I like the concept.
But, for instance, the salad that we were served was basically almost the size of salad you would expect at a restaurant before having an entree. And I just think that was an adaptation to, even the waiter came over and said, oh, you know, like I said, that, you know, you should have three or four plates. I think that was an adaptation to people just maybe not
Americans,
accepting how small the plates were.
Americans like it bigger.
Yeah, big is more.
And the fact of the matter is, in a restaurant, it's not that expensive to give you more. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a mistake that some people make. It's not, you know, by the time it takes, there's a certain amount of money to establishing the plate, taking the order, getting the waiter there, putting it together,
buying
it in the
plate,
pan,
buying a fork,
so if
getting
it's,
a napkin.
If it's 8 ounces of chicken or 6 ounces of chicken, it's not that big a deal in the final price. But what's funny is Americans want more. And in stage left, if we order a 7-course tasting menu, say you order our 7-course tasting menu, it's designed to give you the same amount of food as if you ordered an appetizer, a salad, an entree, and dessert, because the portions are meant to be smaller, because my goal is not to have you walk out holding your belly going, oh, my God, that was so much food. I don't want you to walk out hungry either. But it's funny, and we accept that in French restaurants and contemporary American restaurants, our portions are still much bigger than a restaurant you'd find in France or Italy even.
Right.
But in the Italian-American restaurant, we must give large portions. That's what people want. And
An expectation in that type of that style of restaurant.
And in Catherine Lombardi, you can come in and have a bowl of pasta and a glass of wine and have some food to take home when you're ready to go. That's the expectation of an Italian-American restaurant in this country. It's funny when we think about how people eat in Italy. You know, we've gone out to dinner in Italy many times. And a simple meal might be antipasto, pasta, a main course, and then, you know, cheese or something.
There might be three pasta courses. You might have. I mean, we've gone to meals in Italy where there was antipasto, three pasta courses.
Well, that yeah.
But each course was very small.
Well, yeah, but that, I'm not even talking about those you know, extravagant dinners. I'm talking about, you know, you might at home have the antipasto, and then your pasta, and then an entree, and then something to eat. But they would all be smaller. You know, if you ate in your average Italian American restaurants, the pasta portion, a full order of antipasto, an entree, and then had a tiramisu, you know, you've eaten a lot of food.
Absolutely.
You're in a lot of trouble, man.
Also, the focus in those countries has always been more on lunch than on dinner.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got time to work it off. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk with one of our favorite authors about food, Mark Kurlansky. He's returning to the show. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. And joining us today is Mark Kurlansky. He's one of our favorite authors. He's written more than a dozen books, many of which explore the history of food and humanity. He's written The Big Oyster, Salt, Cod. And recently he's written an article on why kids don't eat their vegetables, how basic and human a subject is that. And his new book is coming out is The Last Fish Tale, Fate of the Atlantic and Survival in Gloucester, America's Oldest Fishing Port and Most Original Town.
Hey, Mark, welcome back to the show.
time. Nice to talk to you.
You know, Mark, you always take simple topics like cod and salt, and you write these wonderful books on them that speak to such a large topic.
I always thought your next book should be salt cod. I always thought that we should do a bacala book.
Well, recently I came across an article you wrote in Bon Appetit about why kids don't eat their vegetables.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really wonderful. Why don't you talk to us about that?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things to this. I mean, it's American kids who don't eat their vegetables. There are cultures. Chinese kids, for example, do eat their vegetables. Probably because it wouldn't occur to a Chinese kid not to eat his vegetables, because they live in a culture where you just don't have meals without vegetables. So that might be the first clue about what's going wrong.
Well, I think the everyone's reaction is to blame in North America fast food and replacement meals and restaurant meals and on our current culture of declining awareness of cuisine. But it goes back further than that in North America and Europe, where there's sort of an aversion to vegetables.
Yeah, I mean, vegetables were never an integral part of our cuisine or Northern European cuisine. They were Italian and the Mediterranean cuisine. A lot of this is about climates. I mean, they're just vegetables weren't that available. I mean, I remember even when I was a kid, not that long ago, there weren't a lot of vegetables available in the wintertime, and it was this very exciting thing when, you know, carrots started showing up from California. I remember that was a very big deal, and remember getting boxes of citrus fruit from Florida?
Oh, sure. Whenever somebody would visit Florida, they would always return with a bag of oranges.
You can still do that. There are places in Central Florida where you can arrange to have a box of oranges shipped to people, but in the north. But
yeah, but
of course,
now
we can just go to a store and buy them.
Now when it arrives, people are like, "Oh, a box of oranges."
Right. And Uncle Max was always a little weird.
Yeah, exactly. Well. So you're saying that, you know, historically in Northern European and North American culture, when vegetables weren't available year-round, were they not a part of the diet even in the summertime?
Not that much. If you look at old cookbooks, I mean, Amelia Simon's cookbook right after the Revolution, which gets credited as the first American cookbook because it was right after the Revolution, only has one vegetable recipe in it, and that's for peas, which, you know, peas are an easy thing to preserve. You can just dry them, and, you know, so they tended to get into diets where fresh vegetables didn't. But there's
no one ever said Amelia was a great chef. We just said she wrote the first cookbook.
Right. But, you know, you see this in... in a lot of cookbooks, in French cookbooks, until after the Middle Ages, you didn't see a lot of vegetables. There weren't a lot of vegetable recipes, which leads us to believe that, you know, vegetables weren't a wide part of the cuisine. So, you know, these are all cultures where vegetables are either a new idea or something added, and they aren't integral to the culture, and somehow that message gets passed on to children. You know, fast food gets blamed a lot, and it should, but, you know, there's a lot of other things going on, like just children's menus in restaurants are the most awful food. I mean, I have a child. I never order from the children's menus because it's just awful fried food.
It's basically battered and fried. Everything battered and fried or mac and cheese. Those are your choices.
Right, exactly. They've decided that's what kids like, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. you know, if that's what you give kids, that's what they like.
If that, if that's what the clown brings you, then the kid's going to like it. You know what I mean? Well, you know, Mark, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment, and I want to talk a little bit more about how this evolved in our culture and what the implications are for it going forward. We're talking with Mark Kurlansky, best-selling author and one of the most insightful authors on food, back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're speaking with author Mark Kurlansky about why kids in America don't eat their vegetables while other kids do. Now, you know, I think most of us look at history, Mark, and think, well, you know, back in ancient times, that meat was, even in Northern European culture, was a luxury for the rich, and that the, we thought, I guess we think that the poor ate vegetables. That, is that wrong?
Yeah. Well, the poor who grew vegetables ate vegetables, but, you know, for example, you know, poor people in urban areas didn't eat vegetables, and, vegetables weren't widely available. People ate grains, you know, in the United States, people ate game a lot.
So it was basically bread and meat.
And squirrel,
yes.
Squirrel's meat, I'm sure.
Well, so, I don't know. Have you ever had it?
You know, I have to say, I used to go hunting squirrel with my dad when I was a kid, and I had...
Okay, you're talking to the wrong guy. Francis has actually had squirrel.
I have. It was a mixed nice sandwich. In when did things change? When did we start to value vegetables, at least in theory, in this culture, in our culture? When did parents start saying to kids, okay, now you've got to eat your vegetables, they're good for you?
Well, people have been saying that vegetables are good for you for a very long time, going back to ancient times. I mean, Pliny said that vegetables were good for you. You know, vegetables weren't widely available in the U.S., except in the summertime, until, you know, within our lifetime.
So why culturally do our kids have what seems like a physiological, because it's in this culture, but why do kids
have that aversion?
Have an aversion to vegetables but not candy?
Well, there is an interesting thing going on biologically. You know, the four tastes, sweet, salty, sour, and bitter. Sweet and salty are the easy sells. Sour is somewhat tougher. And a lot of kids just don't like bitter. And in fact, vegetables are bitter.
Well, and not just a lot of kids. A lot of adults don't like bitter.
Yes. Well, they've done a fair amount of testing about this. And it seems that some people perceive bitter more strongly than other people, and people who have strong bitter receptors don't like it. I was actually tested for this by somebody at Yale just for the fun of it. I mean, they were doing serious research, but I...
But for you, it was fun.
Right.
How bitter am I?
And discovered that I don't have very strong bitter receptors, so... You know, which came sort of as a blow because I like to think of myself as somebody who...
As a super taster.
Right. Right. But, you know, that may explain why I'm very happy having 5 cups of espresso a day.
Well, and having 5 cups of espresso a day may explain why you're very happy all the time.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, Mark, we're gonna go listen to the news, but I want to come back on the other side, and I want to talk more about this and the physiology behind it and why we develop a taste for bitter things as we get older, like coffee and vegetables. And I want to talk about your new book, The Last Fishtail. Will you stick with us through the news?
Great.
We'll be back shortly. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking today with Mark Kurlansky. He's one of our favorite authors on food and culture. He's written Salt, A World History, Cod, A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World, The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell, and his upcoming book is The Last Fishtail, about Gloucester, America's oldest fishing port and original town. But we're talking first about a great article that that you wrote, Mark, in Bon Appetit, where we talk about why kids don't eat their vegetables in the United States. You weigh in on something that is relevant to this topic. There were two books. One was The Sneaky Chef by Missy Chase Lapine, and Deceptively Delicious, which got a lot of press, from Jessica Seinfeld. These are books where parents trick their children into eating vegetables by, like, disguising them, like cauliflower, like, pureed into the brownies and...
Cut your carrot into a boat shape and...
Well, no, even
no,
more than
no, that. No, it's more.
I know, it's much more worse than that.
Right.
It's like, you know, pretend telling your kid it's candy, but you've pureed some spinach and thrown it in there. You're against this, other than the fact that you have common sense. Why?
I think it's just a terrible idea because... First of all, you know, if you're sneaking vegetables into macaroni and cheese without the kid knowing it, the kid is not learning to eat vegetables, just learning to eat macaroni and cheese. And then, you know, when he grows up on his own, he'll eat his macaroni and cheese without vegetables snuck in
it. You die, and then somebody stops putting cauliflower in his, in his macaroni and cheese.
Right. But the other thing that's so bad about it is that I just, as a parent, I think that lying to kids and tricking them is a really bad idea. They tend to find out, and then they don't trust you. And who would blame them?
Mark, some kids are definitely... We talked a little bit about the taste receptors and things like that, but I have four kids, and they're all different as far as their food preference. They all sit at the same table. They all have the same rules, and some of them will choose to skip dinner completely if there's not the right foods to their taste, and some of them will happily eat a green salad during the dinner. What accounts for those changes in taste?
I think part of this may go back to this whole thing about bitter receptors. Some children perceive bitter very strongly, so strongly that it's just really unpleasant. And, of course, greens and vegetables are bitter. And the testing that's been done on this shows that this sensitivity to bitter often goes away with age, which would explain why there's a lot of children who won't eat their vegetables but grow up to like vegetables.
Well, and you also have a very similar thing with coffee, with beer, you know, with red wine.
I had the same thing when I was a kid with strong cheeses. I didn't care for strong cheeses as a child, and now I like them more and more and more.
Yeah, because you're sensing them less and less.
See, don't say that. Sensing food is what my business is all about.
Well, you know, this is why I was such a bloke to me to discover that I'm not sensitive to bitter.
Well, you know, the other thing that I find is interesting is I think I am particularly sensitive to bitter, but I've grown to like it over the years, and I really did. I remember having to force myself to have coffee, and I remember having to force myself to have a beer and then to see through the bitter. And, you know, there have been a number of discussions among my mixologist friends, or our mixologist friends and we, about you know, the American taste for cocktails, and even in the adult beverage world, you know, people sort of start off liking sweet, and there's like the green apple martini, which is made with, you know, people will tolerate like chemically laden, fake tasting apple.
As long as it's sweet.
As long as it's sweet, but for people to, you know, and I think there's a cultural bias as well, for people to start to enjoy, say, Italian aperitifs or cocktails that use Italian aperitifs.
Which are bitter.
They're bitter.
Like Chinara.
Like Chinara, exactly, or Campari or something. They have a little bit of bitterness to them. Well, they have a lot of bitterness to them, and cocktails made with them always have a little bit of bitterness to them. But I think we associate those with adult tastes, you know, that people sort of grow into.
Yeah, and also some cultures are more accepting of bitter than others. I've always found it interesting that if you taste beers from different places, the true beer-drinking countries such as Germany, you know, in the wine regions of Germany, beer is much less bitter than in the beer-drinking regions, and French beer is not as bitter as Northern German beer, and you know, people who, you know, are have their palates cultivated on wine are very comfortable with sour, but not very comfortable with bitter.
Mm-hmm.
So there is always this kind of cultural factor.
A cultural factor, an experiential bias, and what may come from what's available in the region. You know, people in Germany who are in the beer where beer is predominant are in places where grapes don't grow very well.
Right, and the beer they produce, to my palate and to many people's palates, is a very bitter beer.
Yeah, and I love it. Well, you know, I want to take a break, and I want to come back, and on the other side of the break, I want to spend the whole segment talking with you about your upcoming book, which is as yet released. Isn't that correct?
That's right. Comes out in June.
So The Last Fish Tale will come out in June. It's about Gloucester, America's oldest fishing port, and I can't wait to get my hands on an advanced copy. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Mark Kurlansky about a seminal American town. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:41.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and today we're speaking with author Mark Kurlansky. Mark, I want to talk about this new book coming up. I've seen a little bit about it, and the title itself is pretty illustrative. It's called The Last Fish Tale, The Fate of the Atlantic and Survival in Gloucester, America's Oldest Fishing Port and Most Original Town. What are you writing about in Gloucester?
Well, I use Gloucester as a kind of an iconic place. It is an iconic place. It was founded in 1623. As a fishing port, and has been a fishing port ever since. Its economy has always been based on commercial fishing, and everything about the town, its ethnic makeup, its culture, its tradition of artists, everything about the town has to do with commercial fishing. I am trying to pose the question, really, of what are we willing to have happen to our coastlines? Fishing is in a lot of trouble. The tourist industry is booming. But do we really want our coastlines to be nothing but tourism? And I also give some other examples. I get in a little to other places around the Atlantic, but there is this tension everywhere between, you know, should we let fishing die and many places have. Many places in New England, which is where I'm from, that I knew, you know, when I was a kid, I worked on commercial fishing boats, and there were a lot of towns that I knew as commercial fishing towns that are today, you know, just tourism towns.
And is Gloucester going through that same kind of transition, or is it holding on?
Well, it's holding on, but it is struggling very hard to hold on. It's not easy. It's the issue, and there are zoning laws and a lot of things to try to, as they say in Gloucester, keep Gloucester. But, you know, Gloucester is nearly broke, and there's tremendous economic pressure to...
Here in Central Jersey, we have some of the same issues with some of our old farms. You have areas that can be developed for tens of millions of dollars that currently are a 40 or 50-acre farm, and the farmer may be making $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 a year, or maybe even just enough to subsist. And there's this opportunity to make all of this money, but once the farm's gone, it's gone.
Right. And what does a fisherman do who's struggling to earn a living and has all of these regulations and has number of days at sea limited and all of these things, and he suddenly discovers that his little house in blue-collar Gloucester is worth $400,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he sells it and he moves somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the interesting thing, though, I've always found this heart-wrenching, is that we have put such strain on our fish stocks that the fishermen really are caught in the middle. And I think that often, you know, you've seen on the news historically where fishermen have protested against limits on catches. And I remember that seeing fishermen protesting the limits on catches for cod in the Atlantic. Well, you know, the Atlantic cod fishery collapsed because there weren't enough limits on them. And it's a very difficult line to walk to say, listen, you can't...
Yeah, it is a very complicated thing to understand. Fishermen do not want overfishing. Fishermen, you know, have a higher stake than anyone in maintaining fish stocks. Their problem is that they disagree with the way it's being managed. And it's hard to argue with that because the management hasn't been very successful. I mean, in the more than 10 years between my cod book and this book, cod stocks have gotten worse, and that's with, you know, a decade of really determined regulation and real efforts to, you know, try to maintain the stocks.
Well, I was reading an article this past weekend about the California, you know, on the West Coast, the California salmon fishing. They're talking about just absolutely shutting salmon fisheries, not the fisheries, I'm sorry, the commercial salmon down out of for California for the entire year because their stocks are... what the numbers are below 10% of wild Chinook or king salmon are below 10% of what they were just a few years ago, and now they're at levels below what they believe can necessarily bring the population back up, whether it's fished or not.
Yeah, I mean it's very scary. The Bay of Biscayne, which used to be called the Basque Sea, between the body of water between France and Spain. The traditional fishery, one of the traditional fisheries is anchovies. And, you know, it's a part of the Basque culture and a primary catch. And last year, anchovy fishing was just shut down in the Bay of Biscay because it had so collapsed.
Now, what are we doing wrong? How is it being managed incorrectly? And how would the fishermen like to see it managed that may make more sense off of Gloucester?
Yeah, well, there's the big question. Well, it's being managed wrong in that, you know, I mean, the proof that it's being managed wrong is that it's not getting better, although, you know, in some cases of some species, it does get better, but overall, it doesn't. And, maybe partly that regulators are not understanding scientists, or that the science isn't good enough, or that there's not enough consideration for pollution and global warming. We don't exactly know what's going wrong, but what can clearly be seen is that it's not working. Personally, I would like to see a lot more done in terms of limiting fishing gear. I mean, in the last fish tale, I show the whole history of bottom dragging of you know, engine-powered vessels dragging nets off their sterns to catch fish. And there is an exact correlation between that type of fishing and diminished fish stocks.
How do the Gloucester fishermen react to your position on that?
They're not very happy to hear me say that, you know, this should be stopped. They're hoping there's a regulated way out of it. But, you know, there also is a financial way to get them out of it. You know, the truth is that they got into all of this expensive equipment with the help of, you know, soft loans and government and financial institutions and these same institutions.
Sounds like the American way, Mark.
That's right. And so let's use the American way in reverse and get them out of it and get them to more sustainable types of gear. You know, the interesting thing is that fishermen who have gone back to hook and line fishing get the best prices in markets, especially display markets where
where it's not a commodity fish, where you see the fish.
Exactly. Because, you know, if you ever looked at a fish that had been caught in a bottom dragger and a fish that was caught on a line, you would
perfect.
Gladly pay more for the line caught one,
right,
because they get really beaten up in those nets.
Perfect for making fish meatballs.
Yes, right.
Well, think about being the bottom fish in the net when there's 2,000 pounds of fish coming up.
And
absolutely. And they look it. You know, they're all bruised and scratched and people don't usually get to see what these fish look like.
Well, what is the condition of Gloucester? What do you think is going to happen in Gloucester, and what it's an archetype for?
Well, Gloucester has a population that recognizes that it's a very special place, and there's a lot of determination to preserve the fishing industry, even while there's a recognition that the economy has to have other things. And it does now have other things. There's an industrial zone and, you know, fishing may in the future be a much smaller part of the economy. But there is this sense that if Gloucester Harbor isn't about commercial fishing, that Gloucester is no longer Gloucester. I mean, the next town over, Rockport, which used to be part of Gloucester, has become completely a tourist town. It's a town of, you know, bed and breakfasts and little shops and boutiques.
A museum of its former self.
Exactly.
But there's people that would tell you that that's just the changing times and that's what should happen. I'm not one of them, but there are definitely that. I mean, there's an argument.
Those
for
are
that.
People.
There is that argument, and that argument is very, you know, alive in Gloucester. You know, it is a big issue. You know, Gloucester has a mayoral election every 2 years, so that, you know, really keeps the dialogue going.
Well, you know, Mark, we have to leave it there, but I can't wait for your book to come out, and as soon as it does and people can pre-order it, we'll put it up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Great. It's great talking to you guys.
Thanks, Mark.
That's Mark Kurlansky. His book that comes out on June the 10th is The Last Fish Tale: The Fate of the Atlantic and the Survival in Gloucester, America's oldest fishing port and most original town. If it's anything half as good as his other books, it's going to be a must-read for the summer. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1155.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. You know, we're talking with Mark about the salmon fisheries and the fate of Gloucester. I don't know, it gets me a little peeved. One of the things that you brought up was that they're talking about closing the Atlantic salmon...
Pacific salmon.
I'm sorry, Pacific salmon to commercial fishing.
And to sport fishing, too.
Because the levels of salmon have dropped so low, and there is a fear that they may have dropped below the point of collapse. And what people need to realize is that there is a point of collapse. People think, oh, well, you know, when the fish get down too low, we can stop it, and then the fish will always come back. Well, if you go too low, you know, it's a system. There's an ecosystem. And what happened to the Atlantic cod fishery was they went too low, and it's gone.
Well,
they don't fish it anymore, and they're never going to again.
I also think that the easy answer, and a lot of us look to the easy answer, we took too many fish out of the ocean. And that's, and yeah, that may be part of the answer. But having the food there for those fish to eat, having the food for the fish that they eat to eat, having the microorganisms in the water for those fish to eat, this is a system, and it works that way. And one of the things that Mark just spoke to for a moment was the trawling the bottom of the ocean. And when we trawl the bottom of the ocean, we do a lot of damage to the ocean floor.
Right, you rip up the ecosystem that supports the small fish, that support the medium fish, that support the big fish that we eat. And that doesn't come back.
And it doesn't, not for a long, 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 long time.
And maybe never.
And maybe never. We don't know. But the damage that we do in fishing may not just be removing the fish. It may be removing and damaging the other parts of the ocean.
If you have too much pollution that destroys the plankton that the smallest of fish eat that then go up the chain, it's a system, and it's a system that we don't understand, and it's hubris to think that we do. And I'll tell you something. People are a big fan of saying government doesn't work. And look, government's inefficient in a lot of ways. I have a lot of criticism of the way a lot of government programs work. But we have a government to handle issues that involve the whole community that the private sector doesn't handle. The private sector cannot handle cleaning the oceans. The private sector does not handle large issues of taking care of this planet that we live on. We need to come together. The government
There's not a financial gain for a corporation to go out and do that unless we create one for them.
The government is not an it. The government has to be an us in some scenarios, and this is where we need to act together through our government to make sure that we have a planet in good condition to give our kids. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.